You are listening to the Unusually Well-Informed Podcast.
Welcome to the Unusually Well-Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hampton. My unusually well-informed guest today is Dr. Lena Brand Correa. Lena is an assistant professor in the Faculty of Environmental and Urban Change at York University. Today, Lena and I are discussing the ways energy and the decisions we make individually and collectively impact human well-being and the environment. Lena, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Tim.
It's my pleasure. So, Lena, what is ecological economics and why do you focus your teaching and research on it?
Yeah, so ecological economics is it's a heterodox approach to economics. And the main way that it's different from mainstream economics is that it considers the economy as embedded within a wider ecosystem, right? So it considers the economy to be embedded within our Earth and our planetary boundaries and limits. And therefore, the approach that ecological economics takes to understanding the economy is completely determined by that, right? So it considers issues like the scale of the economy is influenced by should be in line with the capacity of our Earth, right? So that's the main thing.
And you have contributed at least two that I've come across terms to the Dictionary of Ecological Economics, which the nerd in me just loves. They always say you should plant a tree before you die, but now I'm thinking I should try to get a word into a dictionary. The two terms that I've come across are the ends means spectrum and ultimate means. How do these concepts shape ecological economics?
Yeah, so those are key terms in ecological economics. They were proposed by Herman Daly, who sadly passed away last year, but he's a very big figure within ecological economics. So the ends mean spectrum, what it means is it's a spectrum of what is it that we ultimately need, so the ultimate ends, and then what are the means that we use to achieve those ends. So it's a whole spectrum of things that we use to achieve certain ends until we reach our ultimate ends. And having that distinction between ultimate ends and ultimate means is quite important because mainstream economics tends to conflate both of them. So mainstream economics tends to prioritize ultimate means as if they were ultimate ends. So for example, the way mainstream economics conceptualizes well-being is through utility, and that is our capacity to satisfy our wants and our preferences through, for instance, increased consumption. But what ecological economics would say, and this means end spectrum would say, is that those are just the means, that what we actually need, the ends in ourselves, the ends in themselves, the ultimate ends are, increased well-being, a sense of fulfillment, all of these sorts of things. And consumption, yes, it's one way of achieving that, but it's not the only way. And importantly, increased levels of consumption have very detrimental effects for the environment in many cases.
It reminds me of something that people have referred to as kind of a perversion of economics. When there's a hurricane, economic activity goes up. That certainly doesn't mean that the people involved in the hurricane, that their well-being went up. So sometimes we're measuring the wrong thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a very big criticism that ecological economics has of particularly GDP, the gross domestic product, which we see in the news all the time. There's this huge worry of GDP is going up or GDP is going down, and seems to kind of shape most of the economic decisions and policy decisions for most countries in the world. But what does it mean really, and what does it measure? So you're absolutely right. It ends up measuring stuff that we don't want it measured, and it doesn't measure stuff that we do want it to measure. So right. You're right. The reparation from natural disasters increase GDP because that increases economic activity. The same as divorce rates and increased medical bills, and none of that is contributing to our well-being, yet we're striving to increase that. And then, of course, it doesn't measure, it measures as positive as increased economic activity, things that can be very detrimental for the environment, right? So increased extraction of fossil fuels, all of these sorts of things contribute to GDP. And then it doesn't measure a bunch of stuff that it's actually quite important for us. In particular, things that we do for each other that don't involve exchange of money and economic activity. So it doesn't measure all the kind of informal care economy type things. It doesn't measure voluntary activities. Things that contribute to community life, that contribute to a sense of well-being and belonging, and then those things don't get measured in GDP, and therefore don't get prioritized in decision making.
Can you talk a little bit about what decoupling means in the context of energy use and well-being?
Decoupling is usually understood and presented as the solution to our environmental issues. And it's based on a let's say a faith or not faith necessarily, but like an optimism on in relation to technological development, right? If we can only do things better and more efficiently, we can still keep growing our economy, but with a reduced environmental impact, right? So if we improve the efficiency of internal combustion engines, we can just keep going. Or if we manage to just decarbonize all of our energy system, then there is no problem, right? So decoupling is usually talked in those terms. However, there's an issue with decoupling, and that's the issue of the rebound effect. So usually when we do increases in efficiency, in whatever it is, because that leads to cost reductions, what it ends up happening is that there's a rebound effect where we end up using more than we were using it originally. Now, this concept of rebound was originally proposed by William Stanley Jevons, and he observed that in England in the 19th century, increases in the efficiency of coal and the steam engine and the coal of use, logically you'd think that that would lead to a reduction in coal use overall. But again, through this mechanism, the cost of things that used coal reduced, and therefore there was an overall increase in coal use, even though we had achieved these efficiencies in steam engines and stuff like that. So, and this is what we observe happening all the time. For instance, we improve the efficiency of internal combustion engines, and those savings, that should be realized in terms of, fewer less fuel use, end up being wiped out because we're producing larger and larger cars, right? So sort of this rebounding thing. So decoupling really is quite limited by the rebound effect, because you can reduce any energy or any resource use as much as you want with efficiency improvements, but if the goal is to keep growing, then those efficiency improvements will be kind of wiped out. So when I talk about decoupling, I like to think of it in a different way, trying to understand what are we trying to decouple from what. So if we focus exclusively on decoupling resource use or energy from economic activity, then we get a very limited view, similar to the one I've just mentioned. But if we try and conceptualize what the role of energy is in a different way, not for economic growth but for well-being, then all of a sudden you get a wider range of alternatives. So yes, you still have the alternatives that are technological. Of course, those are important, and they will continue to be important. And you can still make efficiency improvements, but you can also think about energy in terms of energy services, not just energy itself, but energy services. And you can start to think about improvements around the passive systems. It's called passive systems. So, for instance, it's not just a matter of improving the efficiency of a particular engine or of your gas boiler, but perhaps Think about the, efficiencies in your insulation in your home, right? Just thinking about energy as a service, not the cubic meters of gas, but the thermal comfort you have in your home. And then it opens other decoupling opportunities on the other side of the spectrum. So going towards the ultimate ends type side of the spectrum, where then it's a question of thinking about what is it that we need energy for? And can we use it in different ways to still obtain our goal of well-being? So do we need the huge car? Or is the service that we need getting from A to B? And can we think of different ways of getting from A to B that don't involve a huge SUV, or maybe that don't involve a private car at all? Or, so all of those options open up.
I was reflecting on the notion of the rebound effect, and just out of curiosity, so don't hate me. Everybody makes mistakes when they're young. I used to have a 1987 Cadillac DeVille. Big car, right? Like if you in your mind's eye, you're thinking that must be an enormous car. And the Honda Accord of the day was dwarfed by it. I looked up the specs today, literally within an inch on almost every dimension. And the Accord is actually heavier today than the 1987 DeVille. Headroom, legroom, hip room, trunk space, everything was within an inch. It has grown to the point where it's the size of what was considered a Luxo barge back in the day. And the only difference, of course, there are a few differences. I'm sure it's safer and it corners better and everything, but one big difference is it gets better mileage than the Cadillac did. It probably gets better mileage than the 1987 Accord. And so that speaks to this idea that, well, that's why people drive so much, and so you wind up using almost as much gas as you did before the improvements.
But driving longer distances.
Exactly. And that, of course, contributes to GDP. Me being stuck in traffic and burning gasoline contributes to GDP, but it does not contribute to my well-being, except for the fact that I get from A to B, but just sitting in traffic is not a delight.
But and then so the thing is, if we stay on that realm, that's the kind of technology side of decoupling. But then we need to move to that further question of, okay, why are we going from A to B? Do we need to go from A to B? Is it actually providing us with well-being? Being stuck in traffic is awful, right?
Yes.
It's those sorts of
We
questions.
are broadcasting to the world from Toronto, so we know what we talk about. So this raises a couple of questions about the notion of rational actors. One of the assumptions in economics is that we as individuals make rational decisions for our own well-being with our money, and therefore the world will be fine. If everybody worries about themselves, then the world will be fine. This is called into question. It's not accepted fact. It's just sort of an assumption that goes into how you calculate things, how you work things out. But nevertheless, there are plenty of people who try to come up with ways for people to use their money better for their own well-being. You actually study how people can use energy better for their own well-being. There are two possibilities that flow from that. One is individuals can take that information and run with it. Maybe insulation is a great investment to make. But the other possibility is that there would be interventions by the government to say, no, everybody has to insulate their home. What are some of the outputs that flow from an analysis looking at the decisions that people make with their energy consumption?
No, so that's a really good question. And within energy studies, kind of from a social science perspective, this notion of rational actors is very much put in question, right? What usually comes out is that we engage in energy use through what some authors would call social practices. And what that means is kind of our day-to-day practices of quite mundane things really shape how much energy we end up using and why we use it for. And therefore, this model of we just need to educate people more and just give them the information is not really how to change things. We engage in these routines without thinking about it, right? I don't know, how long is our shower, or how often do we wash clothes, or how do we get from A to B? All these sorts of things are practices that are embedded, and it's not a matter of providing more information, really. It's a broader thing. It depends on the access to different material realities that we have, but it's also the skills that we have to be able to engage with these things, and it's all sorts of cultural and social pressures there. So yeah, so that's around the rational economic man. It's not very well accepted within energy studies from the social science, and also from ecological economics, so very much put into question. But then to answer your question about what to do then? Is it a matter of giving people individual information, or is it a matter of government interventions? I think that the reality is probably a combination of both things, right? To some extent, we do need to give information because people need to have the knowledge and skills to be able to engage with alternative ways of using energy. But at the same time, we need to change the material realities that people engage with, right? Because energy is so much an infrastructure issue, then that will require government intervention or kind of broader intervention. It doesn't have to be kind of central government. It could be at the municipal level. It could be at the community level, right? But it requires changes or interventions beyond the individual.
So a lot of economic theory, at least this is my interpretation, you can correct me, but my interpretation of economics is really studying how we can produce abundance. But one of the challenges that flows from that is also how we distribute that abundance. And there are challenges in that thinking when it comes to energy as well. Some people are in energy poverty. What are your thoughts on that? What can be done about that? How big a problem is it?
Yeah, so just briefly to address the question of what the goal of economics is. From a mainstream perspective, the goal of economics is the efficient allocation of resources. The question of distribution is not really addressed. Through this assumption of efficient allocation, it's assumed that you make someone better off or a group of people better off without making anyone else worse off, and that's considered just. And that's as far as it goes with issues of distribution. From an ecological economics perspective, the goals are different, right? The first goal is to address the scale of economic activity so it's in line with environmental limits. And the second goal is about just distribution, so it tackles distribution quite directly. And then the third goal is around, still efficient allocation. This is kind of from Herman Daly's line of thought in ecological economics. But okay, so leaving that aside, the question of distribution in terms of energy specifically is central, really, because there's huge inequalities, like you said, between countries. There's huge disparities in how much energy on average each country uses. This is when you get to these types of figures that are ridiculous, like, for example, the streaming. I don't know if you remember that video, Gangnam Style, ages ago. So the energy involved in streaming Gangnam Style, however many million times it was streamed, it was more than the overall energy use of Bangladesh in a year, right? So these disparities are huge. They are really, really huge. And this happens within countries as well. So there's huge disparities in terms of, if you look at income brackets, or kind of income deciles, the disparity between the highest energy users and the lowest energy users is huge. And then, like you say, that leads to situations where there's a big portions of the population that are in a situation of energy poverty. In the case of Canada, on average, it has been calculated that it's roughly one in five people, like 20%, which is a huge number, right?
That are experiencing energy poverty.
So, and that's defined as paying a disproportionate amount or spending a disproportionate amount of their income on energy, on household energy consumption. That doesn't include energy for fuel for your vehicle and stuff like that. So only for your hydro and gas or propane or whatever you might be using to heat your home and your water. So this means these are people that are experiencing cold conditions in the winter, but also extremely hot conditions in the summer. People that might live with mold in the winter. This has all sorts of very, very negative health effects. We see rates of death in heat waves or very cold spells going up because of these situations. And it also leads to all sorts of social, detrimental social impact. So if people are in a house that is not, they can't heat to a comfortable temperature, they're ashamed to invite people around, then it leads to a situation of social isolation that way, the same in the summer, the opposite in the summer, and so on. So it's a serious problem.
So I've never been poor, but I've definitely experienced the challenges of not having a lot of money, and as a result, using energy wastefully. I mean, the 1987 Cadillac DeVille, I did not buy it new, and when I bought it, it was cheaper than the competing Accord. Right? The reason I bought it is because it was relatively inexpensive, and yet, as a result, I used a lot more gas than somebody who would have bought the Accord. I lived in an apartment that was basically a concrete box facing south, and I had an air conditioner going full tilt, doing very little. But I didn't pay for electricity, and so there are perverse economics or incentives in places. And then you have people who are truly not well off, and they're using wood to cook or wood for light, and they're getting health problems and eye problems, and also, if you're using coal to heat your home, it's probably not recorded well. It's definitely contributing to carbon, concentrations. So it makes sense. I think one of the outcomes from this analysis is that it makes sense for everyone to at least provide a baseline energy support to people.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's very much kind of a missed opportunity, I think, from the recent federal budget announcement, or the recent federal sort of climate program. Forget the name, but there could have been a much bigger focus on efficiency improvements be precisely because of what you're saying. People who are in a low income bracket cannot afford these infrastructural things that we've been talking about, and that's the challenge with energy, right? Is different from other consumption because it does require big investments, right? If you want to improve your insulation in your house, that's a big investment. All of these sorts of things. So I think that's a big missed opportunity there, and then that relates back to the inequality side of things. Because you can also look at or this distributional question we're talking about, because you can look at energy and different uses of energy depending whether they're related to basic goods or whether they're kind of luxury goods. And you can do that in economics. There's the concept of income elasticity. So if your use of a particular good or service stays the same as your income goes up, it means it's a basic good. That everyone needs it, even as their income goes up. But if your use of a particular good or service increases as your income increases, it's a luxury thing, right? It's something that perhaps you couldn't afford before. And as your income increases, you use more of it. So if you're thinking about policies around this, then perhaps what you want to do is focus on those basic energy services or energy uses, because that's going to be a very progressive thing. So that includes things like heating and cooling in your house, like you said, providing a basic of that for everyone, or things around, well, other basic goods include food and clothing and those sorts of things. Kind of, well, clothing is a complicated one with fashion, but anyway, let's not go there. But then there's other energy uses that are much more in the luxury category. So if you think about international flights, it's usually a very small proportion of the population who can fly once or more per year. And there's even a very, very, even smaller proportion who are frequent flyers. So then Again, thinking about policy options there, then perhaps those are the sorts of things that you can focus on taxing or on limiting somehow, right? Because they won't have a regressive effect.
Another economic concept, or another sort of criticism, I think, you used the term earlier, heterodox, which I gather is the opposite of orthodox. I think the orthodox interpretation of economics doesn't do a lot of work on externalities. It's like, if you can make something and enjoy it or sell it and use that money to buy something else, that's great. Go nuts. But what happens to the rivers and the air and our carbon balance is not considered in that. How does ecological economics look at externalities like that? And also, how do you look at the fact that often the person, like if I buy a dishwasher, I get to enjoy the dishwasher. The person who made it gets to enjoy the money they get. But the person down the river that gets polluted by the production of the dishwasher is the only one to suffer in this equation, and they had nothing to do with the other two things. So how do you look at that in your world?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So actually, within orthodox or mainstream economics, there's a branch called environmental economics, which the name is confusingly similar to ecological economics. But environmental economics within this mainstream economics frame, what it tries to do is look at the externalities and find ways of internalizing them. Because again, the main focus in mainstream economics is not that the economy is within the broader environment, but the economy is the
Is
main
the
focus.
environment.
Yeah. So what they try to do is bring the environment into the economy, right? And the way you do that is by internalizing externalities. So you'd think of mechanisms, for example, in your dishwasher example, you'd think of mechanisms to say, okay, we can quantify the negative effect of the person downstream, and we're going to charge either the dishwasher manufacturer or the dishwasher user a sort of tax, or we're going to provide a subsidy if they manage to reduce discharge. So they internalize. So there's all those sorts of mechanisms. They're called Pigouvian taxes or Pigouvian subsidies. So things like carbon pricing, carbon taxing going to that, right? It's trying to bring the environment into the economy so that then the rational economic actors will make the best decision and we'll all be fine. Now, ecological economics on the other side, okay, acknowledges that these tools might be useful, but if we look at the policy goals of ecological economics that I mentioned earlier, the first one of them is to think about the scale of economic activity, right? So in that sense, the question doesn't become how do we internalize the externality of the dishwasher? The question becomes, do we need all these dishwashers, right? The question becomes, do we need these dishwashers that break every 5 years? I don't know, whatever it is. Do we need to keep in this treadmill of production and consumption, right? That's the first goal. That's the first kind of focus. And the second type of focus, second goal is about distribution. So the second question is, hey, who's getting these dishwashers? Who has access to them? How can we make this more and more equitable, right? And then the third question becomes around efficient allocation. And then all these mechanisms of internalizing externalities, come in there, right? As one tool in the toolbox, but not the main focus, right? So ecological economics would think about more about, trying to bring the scale of economic activity within planetary boundaries. And then, also one way of doing that related to the second goal is to think about distribution. We already have a lot of what we need. It's very unequally distributed, right? That's a major issue.
So one, we have two ways to affect the world around us, or at least if we're lucky enough to live in a democracy, we do. One is with our money, and the other is with our vote. So that provides us with two opportunities to think along the lines of ecological economics. How can I encourage society or the nation I live in or the city I live in to focus on well-being as opposed to consumption? And how can I do that for myself? How do I sort out? Because the thing about voting in any election is there's a million topics considerations on who I would vote for. The environment is just one of them. How do you untangle that in terms of political action?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. I'd say that it's difficult as a citizen to start kind of thinking about this. No mainstream party is saying they're gonna ditch GDP as their main indicator and focus on well-being. However, there have been some interesting developments around the world. So, for example, Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand introduced the well-being budget. And it focused on all sorts of other things. It still had GDP in there, but it focused on all sorts of other things. There are certain other governments, part of the Wellbeing Economy Alliance governments, who are trying to find ways of moving kind of past this quite narrow economic focus. So, for example, Wales has the Council for Future Generations. And what it means is that every economic or policy decision that they make has to be approved by this council. And that, again, shapes all sorts of policy decisions, maybe more along the lines of what we've been talking about. Now, what can you do kind of within your more kind of immediate environment? I don't know, in the case of Canada, there's some interesting initiatives. So there's now a Wellbeing Economy Alliance Canada, and it's in partnership with the David Suzuki Foundation. So I find that initiative quite interesting. And I'd say when you're looking at politicians and who to vote for and all of those sorts of things, see who's talking at things that go beyond balancing a budget or prioritizing economic costs and stuff. But, who's really talking about changing people's lives and people's quality of life. I think that's a good way to start.
So you are a faculty member in at York University in the Faculty of Environmental and Urban Change. What is the kind of research that you're involved with now? What projects are you conducting?
Yeah, so I'm currently involved in a project called Vertical Peripheries. So I'm working with my colleague, Luisa Sotomayor, looking at housing on the outskirts of cities that are usually, big tower blocks put there and people not being able to access, not much provisioning of transportation, of schools, recreational spaces, anything like that. So it's quite a nice interdisciplinary team with two colleagues from the University of Andes in Colombia. We're going to be looking at three cities there, looking at different aspects of these vertical peripheries, from the political economy of them and the planning things to the well-being side of things. So how is it to live in those blocks? And again, trying to look at the relationship between energy and well-being there. These blocks also don't tend to be the most energy efficient. So looking at that aspect as well, and really, looking at issues of energy poverty and, why is it that we're building housing in that way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine it being either very uncomfortable or very inefficient.
Yeah.
What courses do you teach, and what do you anticipate, or what do you see as your students' careers as a result of the courses you teach?
Yeah, well, I teach two undergraduate courses, both in ecological economics broadly. One is more of an introductory one, and then the other one we go into more detail. And I teach two graduate courses. One is on quantitative methods, and the other one is on energy and looking at issues of community energy and energy poverty, kind of more at the local scale. In terms of what my expectations for students in terms of careers, I don't know. I said to them in the last class, which was a couple of weeks ago, that it would be great for them to keep in touch and let me know what they go and do. I don't know. They're going to go and do all sorts of wonderful things, I think. As far as I'm aware, our faculty students end up doing all sorts of jobs. It's because it's a very interdisciplinary program, both at the undergraduate and graduate level. We have lots of students that go and work for the government at different levels, municipal, provincial, federal. But we also have lots of students that go into private companies and become sustainability officers there, for instance, or go and set up their own community organizations and do all sorts of impressive leadership activities. So, yeah.
That's great. So thank you so much, Lena. This has been a terrific conversation. I have one last question. Your career is taking you from Colombia to UK to Canada, and you study energy use and its impact on well-being, which is affected by affluence, culture, the climate that people live in. What energy use practices have you seen in these places that surprise you or dismay you? The most, and what are some easy, quick wins for improving how we use energy for human well-being?
Yeah, so yeah, I've got a few anecdotes related to that. So when I first moved from the UK to Canada, I was absolutely gobsmacked to realize how much of the day the heating is on or the air conditioning is on, and at what temperature the thermostat is put. And I understand Canada is a cold country in the winter, and I'm from Colombia. I'm the first one. I'm not going to say I'd like a cold house. But I think this is a legacy of perhaps very, very low gas prices in Canada. So that's really shocking to me. Whenever I go to and then I'm lucky that within my kind of circle, people are not in situations of energy poverty. So usually when I go to my neighbor's house or my colleague's house, the houses are usually at a very high temperature in the winter, right? That is very surprising. So we packed all sorts of jumpers and blankets and stuff, but we haven't had to use those in the house in the winter, which is quite surprising. And then, for example, I was involved in a project looking at different appliances that countries in Latin America use. And it was very surprising that which are the appliances that are most important, most households have. So you have the typical, something to cook with, a hob, or a TV is always an important one. But then, surprisingly, for the case of Latin America, this was for Mexico and Colombia, the blender came in right on top, right? And this is kind of the cultural influences, right? So it's very important for us to have a fresh fruit juice or something like that. So the
Interesting.
blender is right up there, more than, in some cases, more prevalent than a fan or an
So
air
not just for
conditioner.
margaritas then.
No,
No.
that as well.
No.
But yeah, so those are some anecdotes there. But in terms of thinking about how do we use energy and thinking about different ways of using energy to contribute to our well-being, one concept that I find very useful is that of satisfiers, which is basically the same as saying means in the means and ends thing. So satisfiers are the things that we use to achieve something, to achieve our needs or our ultimate ends. But satisfiers you can classify in different ways. And there's satisfiers that are very synergetic that contribute to several needs or several aspects of your well-being, whilst there are satisfiers that are quite negative, that you think they're satisfying something, but in reality, they're going against your well-being. So one example, kind of one easy example of this is the one that we were talking about in terms of driving a car. We think it's satisfying our need for. And it's not only going from A to B. Cars have all sorts of cultural meanings, which are quite complex, right? It's related to identity. It's related to, all sorts of things. And we think it's satisfying all those sorts of things, and it is, but at the same time, it's impeding the satisfaction of other needs. When you're in traffic for a long time and you get home grumpy, that's not a great thing. We've got the air pollution implications of this, which negatively impact our health, right? So to me, that understanding energy uses in that, and looking at them as satisfiers is quite useful, because then you can start thinking about, okay, is this actually a good satisfier, or is this a satisfier that has negative impacts in other areas of my well-being? And could we be do things differently as a society?
Thank you for a very satisfying conversation. I thank you so much for being on the show, Lena.
Thank you so much for having me too.
My guest today was Dr. Lena Brand Correa. A link to her faculty member profile at York University will be in the show notes. My name is Tim Hampton, and you can reach me at tim@unusuallywellinformed.com.
Thank you for listening to the Unusually Well Informed podcast. The opinions expressed by the host and guests on the Unusually Well-Informed podcast are their own and do not reflect that of their employer or any other affiliation.